Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 533. My name is Camden Busey. I'm back here with another delightful panel. A great book, a great subject to speak about. Let me get back to introducing everybody. We're very happy to welcome back to the program after a little bit of a layoff, Jared Oliphant. He's been busy because now he's a PhD student at Texas A&M University studying philosophy. Welcome back, Jared. It's always great to talk to you.
Thanks, Camden. Good to be back with you.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about, would like you to tell us a little bit about what you've been up to, but not to let him hang on for long. Let me introduce first our special guest today we have. Not that Jared isn't special, but Jared's a panelist today. We're very happy to welcome back to the program our friend, Michael Krueger. Mike is a president and a professor of New Testament at Reformed Theological Seminary in Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome back, Mike. It's always great to speak with you as well.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Love being on the show again. Great to be back one more time.
Yeah, well, we'd love to have you more frequently, not just when books are coming out, but at least at this opportunity, we're happy to speak today about your new book, Christianity at the Crossroads, How the Second Century Shaped the Future of the Church. This is published by IVP Academic in the United States. It's published by SPCK. Overseas and abroad, and they have a wider reach, and there's some interesting stuff in terms of how those relate. But this is a joint project, and Mike can tell us about that in a minute. And we're really happy to talk about this book and a very important subject, and perhaps one that hasn't been treated as greatly and deeply and frequently as we would like. But we'll get into that today. But before we do that, Jared, you certainly been on the program many, many, many times. But you've been real busy and made a little bit of a life transition. Would you tell the people what you've been up to and how things are going studying philosophy down at Texas A&M?
Sure. Yeah, thanks, Ken. I'll try to make it as interesting as I can, given the subject matter.
Interesting but, to certain people more than others. We'll put it that way.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, that's right. No, well, I'll keep it brief. I mean, I am in the first year, so it's spring semester of my first year in the PhD program, and so that just means my responsibilities are taking courses. Typically, you do three courses or seminars per semester, and they also have you teaching. So it's a funded program, and so part of your responsibilities are TAing for a big class. So what I've been doing last semester and this semester is TAing for an undergraduate logic course. And there's close to 200 students in there. And so they break it up. I'm with two other TAs and we each get a section of those students, about 30 for three labs that we do where we're working out problems and those kinds of things. And so that's been great. It's given me some teaching experience, which has been really helpful. And as far as like my own research goes, that's going to, I'm slowly working on it, but mostly getting through the seminars. So I'm taking courses on Kant, and right now I'm in metaphysics, reading a whole lot about that. And I'm actually taking two philosophy of language courses right now, one in kind of the analytic tradition and some application, and then another one that looks at continental philosophy of language. And so we're reading Derrida and Heidegger and Gadamer and those guys. So far, it's just been great. If anyone is looking into getting into philosophy, the program is absolutely outstanding. There are so many great professors. I'm going to interact with them even more closely next semester as I do some directed readings on things. So, yeah, it's so far so good.
That's great. That's great. I've only had one philosophy class in my whole life, at least in the classroom, and that was a PhD level course at Temple for one of my externals at Westminster.
Oh, right.
So yeah, it was kind of funny to be tossed into that. You know, I've learned philosophy and stuff on my own, but in terms of if you look at my transcripts, that's the only one that's going to pop up. And that was interesting as a Christian coming, you know, as an external student from a seminary, you know, you're kind of like an odd duck, and people don't necessarily want to hear your take on things. How have you felt in terms of, you know, being a convicted confessional Reformed guy in the midst of a regular faculty, as a philosophy faculty at a major university?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it's something that I think about in each class. There's a number of answers to that because it's such a complex question. But one answer is I've just been surprised at how much I guess you could say kind of theology or philosophical theology, something in that ballpark has cropped up in almost every one of my seminars. I mean, when we were looking at Kant, we were looking at his second critique, and there's a lot of material in Kant about religion in general and God and those kinds of things. And so that just organically happens to come up when in a seminar we're discussing those types of topics. But I don't know. It's something that I continue to think about. When you're in the philosophy world and you're doing especially history of philosophy, that comes up a lot too, sure, because pretty much everybody before the 20th century was interacting in some way with theology of some sort, mm-hmm, and the God question. But I would say everybody here is really friendly. It's when you're in the Texas A&M PhD program, you have to do a master's program in another discipline. And so my master's is, I've already done it in theology. And so when people ask me what I'm doing my master's in, I tell them I already did it in theology. That obviously opens up a whole lot of questions and dialogue and conversations, mm-hmm, which can be interesting. So my experience so far is it's been really good and people like to engage those questions. So we'll see how it goes. Ask me in a year.
That's great. That's great. Yeah. And certainly, you know, there are different aspects of things, and we can, you know, studying someone and doing the history of philosophy is one thing, you know, agreeing with an unbelieving philosopher is another. And so there's all different ranges and aspects, and as you have been and continue to do, just keep 2 Corinthians 10:5 in mind and keep charging forth, but doing so with love and charity. And I'm excited to see all the things you're up to and how things are going to work out for you in the future. These are exciting times.
Yeah, thanks.
You're welcome. Mike, we're obviously glad to have you back with us today, and some of this discussion is certainly not off topic, because certainly in the second century, the church is wrestling with and dealing with philosophies that are going on and trying to figure out what their place is, and the world themselves is trying to figure out who these Christians were, what they believed, and how they fit into all the mix. You know, but as we turn now to this book, Christianity at the Crossroads, this is really a great book. I'm glad I have this now, and I can put this on my shelf. I wish, not to say anything bad about the existing literature or the stuff that I was assigned in my classes, but I really wish I had this when I took what was called New Testament Introduction at Westminster. This kind of would have been kind of a catch-all book that probably would have been the one book to rule them all for the time, rather than being assigned 10 or 15 other books and reading 10 pages or so out of each and every one of them. Mike, could you tell us a bit about just your process in terms of writing this book and its need, and how this all came about?
Yeah, so this book is the result of actually many years of reflection on the second century. Those who are familiar with my prior writings know that a lot of the things I've written on before sort of dabble in the second century. Things related to the development of the canon, of course, things related to the transmission of the New Testament text, and then issues related to heresy and orthodoxy. For whatever set of reasons, all seem to have the second century as a major time period where those issues were front and center. And so up until now, I've just been in the second century and around it and have really found it to be interesting and critical time period. At the same time, one of the things I've noticed is there's very little written about the second century, at least comparatively. Now, of course, there's lots of topics in the second century that have occasioned a good bit of writing on a number of different things. But when you look at the early Christian movement as a whole, there tends to be a lot, certainly about the first century. That's no surprise, because we got our New Testament writings that tell us a lot about that time period. Mm-hmm. And then we have, you know, centered around Constantine, Nicaea, 4th century, and even 3rd century patristic scenarios, because there's so much more to read and so much more available. But the 2nd century sits sort of squashed in the middle, I think easily overlooked, but I think it might be one of the most important centuries out there in terms of understanding how Christianity kind of learned to stand on its own 2 feet and grew up a little bit. So this is sort of Christianity in its adolescent years, if you will, before they really matured, and I found it to be a fascinating time period.
Yeah, I find it to be one of those time periods that is crucial. It's very important, but it is kind of at the seams, and sometimes the stuff at the seams isn't dealt with in great detail, at least when it's put into a seminary curriculum, for example. Is I just recall how much we learn and stuff, and again, I'm not saying that this is a fault of my professors at all. I'd say this is a fault of the student, but the way things are, you know, when you come up to the end of a New Testament introduction, you're not necessarily going to come in and talk about the second century as much. And then when early church picks up you know, the big thing, you start to talk about Nicaea, but what about before that? You might have some a few comments or some things to read about before then with the Greek apologists and other figures like that, but it's not a segment that is really given great attention, you know, certainly nothing of the sort like you do with the Reformation, for example, and it's just kind of lost in the balance. But it's a such an important period of time, as the church is, like you say here, the title, at the crossroads, and figuring not only what happened then, but how it also comes to influence us today. You know, in your studies, what did you find here? Were you surprised by any of your research? Did anything of these years of reflection, and especially when you're starting to put together this particular book, not just studying the things as you have been for years and years, but writing this book, did anything surprise you in your research?
Yeah, I think one of the things I found very interesting is looking at the second century without necessarily looking at it in light of how it all ended. And this was sort of a fresh take. So we know, of course, the church succeeded, if we can use that term. It triumphed, it prospered, it grew. And so here we have Christianity today as a global phenomenon in many ways. But what I've tried to do in the book is look at the second century in through their eyes. What would it have been like to be in the second century and not know that the church was going to prosper, grow, succeed, and not treat those things as a given? And so that's actually what guided the book a lot, was Christianity found itself very much at a crossroads there. Where were they going to make it? You know, were they going to survive? Well, we don't really ask that question very much because it's obvious they did. But you know, it's kind of like trying to read a book without knowing what the last chapter is. You know, we know the last chapter, or at least the chapter up till now. But I tried to look at it with a different lens. And when I did, what I noticed was that there's just a lot of things Christianity had to figure out in the second century. Now, when I say figure out, that doesn't mean that the Christian religion was up for grabs, as if the Gnostics were equally as valid as the Orthodox. But there was still a lot to sort of work through and deal with, and things they faced that they wouldn't have known they were going to face. And you just realize that they it was a crucible. They endured a lot. And it was that transitional time period, I think, that made the church what the church ended up being.
Yeah, I don't know if this is overstating the case, but it did. While I was reading it, it just struck me, and correct me if I'm wrong or if you have a different take, but humanly speaking, it did seem like Christianity was just humanly speaking, it might not have survived because of the pressures that were going with multiple cultures that were not exactly friendly. And I'm thinking of Christianity's relationship to Judaism and Christianity's relationship to the Greco-Roman culture. And you just had odds stacked against them, I could say, in the second century. And it did seem a bit different from the first century. I didn't know if that was something that you wanted to talk about as far as those external pressures coming in on Christianity, maybe in a different way from the first century. But I appreciated the way you stated that because it hadn't struck me in that way before. I didn't know if you wanted to speak on that at all.
Yeah, I think you could say that Christianity was sandwiched between two opposing forces. You know, they had basically distinguished themselves from Judaism, if we can even use that language. You know, obviously we think that Christianity inherited the Old Testament rightly, so it's not, we wouldn't really think of Christianity as a separate religion, but for the sake of nomenclature, they had separated themselves from Judaism, so they weren't Jews in the minds at least of the Romans, okay? And then the Romans didn't accept them because they were exclusivistic in their religious practice and did not worship the Roman gods, and so they were sort of homeless, if you will. You know, religiously speaking, the Jews rejected them because they embraced Christ as Messiah. The Greco-Roman world rejected them because they wouldn't pay homage to the Roman gods. And so they were kind of getting it from both sides. And, you know, one of the things that made Judaism interesting is that the Greco-Roman world didn't really pressure Jews in exactly the same way because they regarded Judaism as a national religion. And so they were really willing to let Jews sort of have their own national religion. But Christians, of course, weren't related to just one nation. They were cross-cultural. They were affecting every people group. So that's where the change came. Christianity wasn't viewed as a religion just tied to one ethnicity. So suddenly now it looked like a big threat because the Roman government wasn't going to have that. They weren't going to have this sort of transnational religion that was going to suck everyone away from worship of the Roman gods. So yeah, I think you look at Christianity and think, you know, how did it make it on a human level? And of course, there's from a divine perspective, we believe Christ promised to preserve his church. But on a human level, it was definitely a period of much trepidation.
Mm. As you continue to develop this book, I love how you've laid this out, this case here in this book, and you speak about key issues in the second century. We'll get to all these as we continue discussing, but there are sociological, ecclesiological, doctrinal, theological transition, then there's textual, canonical transitions as well. There's all sorts of things moving around, but just to come back to the nature of this particular study, how comprehensive are you trying to be? I mean, could you just give people a little bit of a taste of how this book is laid out, so that as they go buy the book, hopefully right now, they'll know what to expect?
Yeah. So obviously, there's a lot of things to say about the second century, and this book was not designed to be exhaustive, needless to say, nor was it designed as an academic monograph. If it were to be an academic monograph, I probably would have picked just one of these topics, or maybe even a subset of that, and written 300 pages on that. What this is designed to do is to be an introduction to the key issues going on in the second century, which I think is the type of introduction that even interested lay folk would benefit from and enjoy. And so I lay it out basically in, as you just indicated, each chapter deals with a different kind of transition that Christians were going through. So you deal with sociological issues in terms of figuring out who they are as a people. There's church issues in terms of how it's set up and how the churches relate. There's theological issues, of course, in terms of what they're going to believe. And then there's textual issues in terms of what they're going to read and copy. And then on top of this, there's political issues. You know, how do they relate to the new world they find themselves in? So when you look at that swath of issues, what I think is perhaps interesting about the book is that no matter what the reader might be interested in, I'm hopeful they'll find something in the book that they connect with. So every reader has their own interest, but second century dealt with so many issues that you can find an issue that interests you in that. And I think it just has a lot to say to the modern church as we reflect upon it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I we've been talking even before we started recording, but just to share with the listeners as well, I really enjoy how this book is laid out and the way you've designed it. It's very clear. I was having a conversation with my wife about this, and I'm surprised at how many nonfiction books there are out there that are unclear. and you're trying to think, we don't need to hide what we're trying to say. You know, this isn't a fiction book with a big reveal at the end or anything. It's just, we're trying to be as clear as possible to communicate this information in a way it's enjoyable, obviously. We don't want it to be dry and you know, not exciting to read. But it's laid out in such a way where you can look at it and say, wow, I see exactly what he's trying to say, and now I can dive in and go deeper. And then, so there are all these different chapters in the book, but then even within the chapters, there's, you know, a very clear introduction and conclusion for each chapter. So, I mean, I don't know if you intended it this way, but I mean, even when I wrote my dissertation, I kind of wrote it like this. I won't say that it's to the quality or the level of your writing at all, but, you know, read the introduction of the whole book, read the conclusion of the whole book, and then read the introduction and the conclusion of each chapter, and then go back and start reading the whole chapters. You get a really good sense of the whole thing right there. And there's no surprises. And I really appreciate that. And it's just laid out very well.
Thank you. Yeah, I tried to write it in a very straightforward way. I wouldn't describe this book at all, and I don't think anyone would, as flashy or provocative or, you know, cutting edge. And we all know how the publishing world works today. If you want to sell a lot of books, typically you're going to be one of those things.
Yeah.
You know, that's fine. That's not what this book is trying to do. I think when someone picks this book up, as you said, it'll be very clear what I'm trying to do. I'm not trying to do anything sort of flashy or original here. I'm just trying to give people the big picture of what happened in the second century and why that matters for today. So yeah, it's going to be a straightforward, non-confusing, hopefully, read. But I think that's exactly what I was trying to do, and hopefully people will find that refreshing.
Yeah, I believe they will. Mission accomplished on that regard. So let's dive in then here after the introduction. Then we have the first chapter you've titled A Peculiar Identity. And the sociological makeup of second century Christianity. So this is really dealing with who these people are, how they relate to other social groups. And of course, one of the biggest relationships, we see this even right in the New Testament, is the interaction between Jews and Greeks. But you lay this out even as Paul says, you know, there's neither Jew nor Greek, neither slave nor free, nor male nor female. And those are all subheadings under here. So let's talk about the Jews and the Greeks, for example. What were some factors here in how these two groups were separated from one another, but how they have been brought together by Christ, how this dividing wall has been broken down?
Yeah, I mean, this is the big the big sociological transition I start with is, how did Christianity become Christianity and not just a sect within Judaism? And this is an enormous subject, and I'm sure you both know there's a lot written on it. There's a lot of debate about it. You know, did these two groups even split ever? If so, what do we mean by these groups? I mean, could we even use the term religions in this time period that could separate from one another? And I tried to synthesize all that down and make this not overly complicated due to all the backstory here within scholarship. But the quick version of it I laid out in the book is, look, by the time the second century starts, which of course is the time period under consideration, largely speaking, although not absolutely, Christianity has become its own thing. And what I mean by that is that no longer was it viewed just simply as a sort of intra-Judaistic dispute about which Messiah they're going to follow. Rather, it's seen as its own separate religion, if that term is useful. There's lots of ways to tell this. One is the way Jews and Christians speak about each other. I track that. But even more importantly, I think it's interesting how the Greco-Roman world viewed Christianity. In the first century, they typically viewed it largely as a sort of a Jewish dispute. By the time you get to the second century, that's not the case. Christianity is clearly something different in the minds of the Romans. It's a threat, whereas Judaism isn't the same sort of threat. And so in their mind, these things are different. They've separated. They've been distinguished from each other. So I talk about that and the influx of Gentiles and how Christianity became transnational. And this is, of course, its greatest strength and its greatest weakness. And what I mean by that is its greatest strength, it's for everybody, but it made it very vulnerable because it made it a threat. Once it was for everybody, then the Romans noticed and they didn't like what they saw because they felt like Christianity was affecting the broader pagan world in a way that Judaism never did. And I think that leads to some of the reasons why it was so vigorously opposed.
Yeah, and part of this was a great chapter. One of the main things that I got out of it, or that I guess I learned, was there are so many comments on the perception of Christianity as kind of compared to other religions out there, but its respectability. And so you can elaborate on this, but at least for some people, Christianity was, it was not the very educated who were a part of Christianity. It was kind of, looked down upon. And you have a section that indicates that the ratio of men to women is very interesting too, if you want to talk about that. But the perception of people at large, their perception of Christianity, I thought was really fascinating in that we're seeing some of the same things today, obviously, so it's kind of, transtemporal in a lot of ways, but specifically for the second century, I don't think I'd ever thought about, how do people think about it as far as, just a philosophy that gets into the next chapter, but just a system of thinking and the type of people that were involved in Christianity. Can you talk a little bit about that, their perception?
Yeah, I think, as I indicated, there's modern perceptions of who early Christians were, and then there's sort of second century perceptions of who early Christians are. And I think what's interesting is this chapter sort of tried to break down the misconceptions. And the way I did that was showing that Christianity just cut across so many different lines that people like to draw, but aren't accurate. And so one of the lines, of course, was, the ethnic Jewish versus Gentile line. But the other line that Christianity crossed, of course, as you indicated, Jared, was the socioeconomic line. It was a religion that wasn't just for the poor, and it wasn't just for the rich. It was kind of for everybody. So there was educated, non-educated, there was aristocratic and peasant class, all in the same religion. And this was, again, very peculiar and troubling for people. And also, how do you handle that? What do you do with that? And then there's the women and men issue. And this is another thing I think that was great to see broken down. There's this perception amongst modern people, at least, that Christianity is hostile to women and that, it's oppressive to women. And I had a conversation just the other day about it with a college student I was talking to, and she was convinced Christianity was oppressive to women. And I said, well, you can read this section in my book, because apparently the early Christian movement, didn't have any trouble attracting women. In fact, if you ask the Greco-Roman women what religions they prefer, they flocked to Christianity and drove. So they did not find it oppressive. They did not find it, at least in their terms, problematic, but refreshing and attractive. And so I think this chapter is very, very interesting because it sort of blows up a lot of modern critiques as well as ancient critiques. And I think that's why it's helpful.
Yeah. What about the political and intellectual acceptability of Christianity at this time? I mean, what were some of the challenges they were facing, and did they make any inroads in particular ways, or was it basically kind of an uphill climb in every facet?
Yeah, chapter two, I dive into that issue in depth, and I found this to be personally one of the most interesting chapters. I suppose the reader will have his own take on what they find most interesting. I enjoyed chapter two a lot because I found it interesting to ask the question of why Christians were seen so negatively in the ancient world. And the reason I found it interesting because of how much it parallels what's going on in the modern world. So I broke the chapter down into two parts. One was intellectual acceptability, and the other one was sort of political acceptability. And let me just start with the second one. Christians, of course, were being persecuted, they were being arrested, and they were being killed at points. And so people were like, well, why? What would make the Romans do this? Because, I mean, everyone knows that the Roman world was a polytheistic world where there was many religious systems, and it was supposedly tolerant, and you could just believe whatever you wanted, and there wasn't sort of a one-size-fits-all. So wouldn't they just accept Christianity along with every other religion and just not even notice? Why pay attention at all? And I think that was the critical question that I wanted to answer. And the upshot of it, there was lots of nuance to this, but the upshot of it is that it was all about the exclusivity of Christianity, 100%. It wasn't the idea of a new religion. It was an idea of a religion that would not accept the worship of any other god but their own. And so this is where the Roman world interestingly moved from tolerant or supposedly tolerant to intolerant very fast. So they're tolerant as long as you don't claim to be exclusively the only right way. And as soon as you do, the Roman world cracked down hard. And the reason they did is because they felt like that would keep the Roman gods from being rightly honored, and that would put Rome under the sort of the danger of being, invoking the anger of the gods. And so Christians were critiqued precisely for their monotheistic exclusive identity. And that obviously has just massive parallels today. Every time I read about it, I was like, this sounds like today over and over again. Mm-hmm. And I think anybody reading it would make those links pretty clearly.
Yeah. Who were some of the figures in that early time period in terms of people that are coming up as being leaders of the early Christian church that are dealing with some of these factors, whether they be political or intellectual?
Yeah, well, we've got obviously numerous martyrdom accounts, which I think play a role in terms of seeing the political side of the persecution. I mean, two of the most obvious in the early days were Ignatius, Polycarp, and then you could add Justin Martyr to that as well. And then, you know, you've got all kinds of different sort of intellectual folks who basically come to the fore and begin to write to defend Christianity against its attackers. So these were the early Christian apologists, one of which, of course, was Justin Martyr. You have others, Tatian, Athenagoras. But I think one of the most obvious ones during this time period was Tertullian, who, you know, arguably is the greatest Christian apologist during this era and just has written an apology that is so applicable to today that when I read it, I thought to myself, I've read this before, but I'm reading it with fresh eyes because the arguments Tertullian is making and the things he's saying could have been written last week.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very good lesson about how nothing new under the sun comes, and that the same Christian issues or same issues Christians faced then are being faced today. And so chapter two was for me at least really important to understand the connection between the second century and the modern church.
Yeah, there's a great quote that you include. I think it's actually in the introduction, but it applies to this chapter. It's from Eric Osborne, and he said, Christian philosophy begins in the second century, which I found interesting. So can you give us a
quote, Jared?
What's that?
I knew you would like that quote.
Yeah, of course I'm going to highlight that one. Yeah, right up my alley. But I was wondering if you could give people just a snapshot or a picture of what he might mean by that. You mentioned some of the figures, but especially in maybe a transition period from the first century, what was going on in just Christian thought, Christian philosophy? How did that develop?
Yeah, so one of the premises of that chapter is that theological development, philosophical development, if you will, is usually the result of external sort of resistance or attack. So what you look at providentially when you look back on the second century is you see that God used the attacks of Greco-Roman philosophers on Christianity to help Christians sharpen, clarify, and better articulate what they believed. And so the second century was a time of transition because, you know, Christians knew what they believed on one level, but once they had to defend it, then they had to really be able to articulate what they believed. And so you realize at that point that the intellectual, philosophical acumen of Christianity had to step up. And so what Osborne meant by that quote is that second century was the time when Christians began to do this. They began to say the things and articulate the things in response to their attackers that needed to be said. And it helped Christians hone their theology and really, really start thinking philosophically. You know, I mentioned in this chapter a number of who those attackers are. And these are well-known figures. You know, everyone from Celsus to Galen to Lucian. These are all the guys that are piling on Christianity. And that is an opportunity for Christians to step up and really be clearer and more thorough about what they believe. And that, too, of course, is relevant for the modern day, because there's a lot of Christians that go off to college that are true believers, but it's not until they're forced to defend their views that they really have to become theologians.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's mm-hmm. really helpful. And then maybe just one more self-indulgent follow-up for me. I didn't did you see interaction with particular philosophers from this period? Like, did you get a sense that a lot of them were interacting with any individual? And, you know, Plato and Aristotle are the ones that come to mind, obviously. But I'm not so familiar with that time period to know what was prominent during that time as far as sources go. Can you give a picture of that?
Yeah, those are issues I wasn't able to dive very deeply into here for space reasons. But it's interesting to note that there's been a lot of discussion about the Platonic influence on Christians during this time period and whether they were trying to make Christianity sound more like the kind of God that people would receive in a Platonic world or under a Platonic sort of philosophy. And so this particularly becomes acute with Justin Martyr, who seems to have some of this in his teaching, and people wonder, is he trying to appeal to that segment? Other writers do this too. So, you know, the apologists were complex folks. Some of them did a fantastic job. Some of them didn't. Some of them tried to shape Christianity around the philosophical popular views of the day and ended up, you know, making the Christian God sound more like the Platonic deity. And so there's a lot of that going on. Unfortunately, in the book, I didn't really dive into it much. And Eric Osborne's a great place to go for some more of this, by the way. He's written a number of things on this period, and he dived more into those issues than I was able to do.
Great. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. Are there any, just again, self-indulgent, but maybe this will help Jared, and I'm sure many of our listeners who are very interested, is there some references or anything in the bibliography or places to go to, or any books you might suggest to read more about that?
Well, about that narrow issue, I think, Eric Osborne's the best first place to go, but broader in terms of early Christian interactions with government and politics and they're being attacked. I would just mention Larry Hurtado's book, basically Destroyer of the Gods, that came out a little behind.
Yeah.
And again, he doesn't deal with the philosophy side as much. He does deal with the sort of how was Christianity viewed by the mm-hmm. Greco-Roman world on an intellectual level and how that played a role in their distinctiveness.
Yeah, and that's so recent book too. Was it 2016 or so?
In fact, I had to read a pre-pub copy of that from Larry before so I could at least have it in my head as I line up. I wasn't really even able to use it. I mentioned it in the introduction.
Yeah. Very good. Very good. Now, I really wish we could get, we could have had our buddy Glenn Clary on for this next chapter, and perhaps we can talk again in the future about worshiping Jesus here, the ecclesiological structure of second century Christianity. Now, Mike, we all know beyond a shadow of a doubt that Acts 15 describes the first general assembly, but...
exactly.
But are you telling me that there was an emergence of a single ruling bishop at some point in time? How did all that come about, and how was the church dealing with the changes in the establishment of a more or less a working book of church order and form of government?
Yeah, in chapter 3, where I deal with worship, I kind of look at it largely from an ecclesiological perspective. You know, what did what did Christians do when they worship? Who did they gather together? What did their meetings look like? What did the meetings include? Who were these church groups? How did they relate to one another? So it was a lot to cover in one chapter. And as you guys know, there's many, many books written on many subpoints in this chapter. But one of the big ones was the ecclesiological transition in terms of church government. And I got to say, of all the chapters in this book, this is one of the hardest. Hardest, and what I mean by that is the most complex. There's a lot of contradictory evidence in the historical record that you could see how people could read in different ways. It's just fuzzy and foggy and not as clear as we wish it was in the second century in terms of reading the tea leaves about church government. I think, you know, we have a lot clearer record in the New Testament itself than we do in the second century. And so by the time you get to the second century, it's just a very complicated thing. And what I found as I did the research is that there were scholars that looked at the same pile of evidence and reached diametrically opposite conclusions, which is, you know, maybe not as rare as we would think, but still notable here that this was just not a place where there was much agreement. But in essence, what I argued is that there was an ecclesiological transition. So in the first century, I argued that there was a general pattern of churches being run by a plurality of elders. And that by the time the second century ends, you have a general pattern where churches are being ruled by a singular bishop. So somewhere in there, in that 100 years, roughly, that something changed. There was a transition. Some will laud that transition as positive. Some will say it wasn't. I didn't really deal with that issue. I just wanted to track the transition and talk about when and how it happened. And I think that second century was the time in which it happened.
Yeah, yeah. What were some other issues going on in terms of, elements of worship too? I mean, sometimes it's really interesting to think about how this was going on in this more specifics as Christianity started to take shape and the practices and the particulars, things that we might take for granted now, back then are certainly different. What were some of the elements of worship and how did those start to form?
Yeah, one of the things I was encouraged by as I was diving into the sources, and I knew this already, but it was encouraging to see, and that is just how similar the worship services are then as today. And of course, that's a very broad statement because someone could look at the church today and say, wow, churches are very different today. You go to one worship service and you get something completely different than another worship service. And yes, that's true. But in terms of the basic elements, it is amazing to see how in 2000 years, there's not been a lot of change. And I laid out the elements. I mean, there was the gathering element, which is Sunday worship on the Lord's Day for the most part, often in the morning, although sometimes at night too, Christians would come together. There was a word element, a teaching, preaching element that was absolutely central to early Christian worship. And obviously that's still true or should be true today. There was a what I call a washing element, which is a reference to baptism and the importance of that rite as a entrance into the church. And then there's the eating together, the meal portion of the Lord's Supper. So you've got word and sacrament, basically, when you start boiling it all down from the very beginning. And you read, for example, Dustin Martyr's description of worship in the second century, which had been fairly reliable and fairly typical, given that it was probably located in Rome. You could have almost written it about it at worship service today. And so there's something very stable about that, I think, and encouraging that God has set up worship in a certain way to include word and sacrament from the very beginning, and Christians have been doing that for 2,000 years. Yes, with differences here and there, but those were the core elements. Now, there's other elements I didn't cover. I didn't really cover singing. I didn't cover prayer. I didn't cover tithing and monetary aspects. Those are all important, but just weren't able to sort of fit into this chapter. But I was encouraged to see the continuity.
Yeah, this was a great chapter. I really enjoyed it. One of the helpful things that you do cover is the broader culture's misunderstanding of what was going on in worship and what Christians were doing. I mean, it was everything from, I think, you know, there are accusations of incest and cannibalism, and there seemed to be some weird, persistent rumor that Christians were actually eating a baby during part of their worship service. I mean, just crazy stuff going on. So can you talk a little bit about why those accusations were made. I'm sure part of it was misunderstanding some of the language involved, but I'm sure another part of it was just trying to slam Christianity because of what it is too, and maybe starting rumors for that reason. But what was going on in terms of the public's perception of worship services?
Yeah, so what was driving this largely was the fact that Christian worship was not public. And what I mean by not public isn't that your neighbor couldn't come if they wanted to. That's not what I mean. By not public, I mean it was not a religious system that was received by the Roman world. And Christians were forced to worship in private homes and at times that were either early in the morning or late at night. And so already out of the outset, you've got this sort of secret meeting problem. Now, in the history of Rome, and I brought this up, there's been other religious groups that Romans were suspicious of due to their secret meetings. And so part of this is just by virtue of the fact that Christianity was unknown, people start filling in the blanks, right? They start thinking, well, maybe they're doing this and maybe they're doing that. And so the secrecy factor played a role. Christians weren't obviously flaunting their worship on the street corner. And so people began to speculate about what they were doing. Also playing a role, no doubt, is just that once you determine that the Christian religion's a problem, people just sort of pick stock accusations. So it's not so much that Christianity was accused of these things because of necessarily what they were doing. I'll come back to that in a minute. But this is just the kind of thing you said about secret groups. You would say, well, they're sexually licentious or they're cannibalistic. Those were sort of stock accusations in the ancient world that weren't unique to Christianity, actually, and that were made of other groups. And then there's the concern that maybe some of it was occasioned by Christian language, you know, the Eucharist or the Lord's Supper being something where you're eating the flesh of Jesus. Could that have been a reason why people thought that was happening? Well, it's hard to know. I will add one thing, though, that I think probably did play a role, and that was the presence of women in worship. You know, you have that gender line being crossed. A lot of Roman religions were very gender separate. And some religions were male only, actually, in the Roman world. So here you have a religion that's both male and female. They're both participating in these secret meetings, either late at night or early in the morning. You can imagine that scene a bit scandalous. And so part of the speculation is that it was actually Christianity's crossing over the male-female barrier in terms of including men and women, not just men, that would have played a role in part of the speculation.
You know, in the next chapter, this is really perhaps one of the most interesting questions or thoughts for me. I was fascinated by the entire book, but when you start to speak about alternative pathways, diversity in second century Christianity, obviously there's a lot of connections today, especially with what was it last summer with all the eternal subordination of the Son disputes and all of these things coming up. These Orthodox doctrines were formed early in the church, but here in the second century, it seems as if so much of this stuff's in flux and there's always these new movements and new heretics coming up, you know, popping up left and right. But the question here really is, what did second century Christians believe? And, you know, following along that, how much diversity was present among them? And was there even such a thing as orthodoxy at the time? Or was it just a, you know, kind of like a pre-postmodern world, if you will, you know, even before modernity? Is this just, you know, everyone fend for themselves in diversity, or was there an orthodoxy to uphold?
Yeah, great questions. And certainly, you know, chapters 4 and 5, where I cover those sorts of issues, are really core chapters in this book, because I think a lot of people who are picking this book up, they may be interested in lots of things in it. But my hunch is, particularly based on other things I've written, that they're going to want to really read chapters 4 and 5, because, as you indicated, that's where I deal with the diversity question. And I deal with the diversity question because that's all the rage today in modern scholarship. When modern scholars talk about early Christianity, they love talking about diversity, how no one could agree on anything, and there was all these different views, and there was a complete sort of theological mess. And you know, it wasn't until the 4th century that it all got hammered out, and it was sort of every man for himself, if you will, theologically speaking, in these early centuries. Now, that whole line of thinking, of course, isn't new. It goes back to Walter Bauer and his book on orthodoxy and heresy, but it of course predates Bauer too. Just this idea that Christianity was a theological battleground that wasn't really solved until Constantine, who hammered it all out at Nicaea or something like this. I challenge that head on in these chapters. And And I do it in a way that I hope is balanced, because I think both sides make a point here. And in chapter four, I say, look, there was diversity, and there was a good bit of it. There were strange groups and strange teachings and heretical sects and Gnostics and, you know, sort of the radical Jewish Christian groups, and you've got the Montanists, and it was very complicated, and it was very hard, and there was a lot of fighting going on. However, that's not the whole story. I also, in chapter five, argue that there was also a lot of common ground, and there was a core set of beliefs, and that there was an Orthodox party in the majority. So is there diversity? Yes, but that doesn't negate a very clear core trajectory, which I argued for. So those are what I'm trying to do in chapter four and five, and I hope it made some advancing of the discussion over diversity.
Mm-hmm. No, I thought it was really fascinating.
Yeah, I found it helpful too. And especially, I mean, you go into some detail about the rule of faith. And I think some listeners will definitely be interested to hear you describe what it is and how it functioned in this period, and maybe how it was, in some sense, a trajectory towards creeds and confessions later on. But what was going on with the rule of faith in the second century and some of the figures that were involved with that?
Yeah, so one of the major ways that Christianity expressed its theology, and one of the major ways that tied Orthodox Christians together was the thing called the rule of faith. And the rule of faith was just basically a quick summary of what Christians believed. It's kind of got a creedal feel about it, but it's different from creeds because it wasn't fixed wording. You know, like, you know, think about like the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed, it's fixed wording. That the rule of faith wasn't fixed wording in the sense that it's always the same language, but it's the same theology and the same general flow of theology that talks about what Christians believe about creation and God and humanity and Jesus and salvation, and there's definitely a creedal vibe about it. But it was a way to articulate what Christians believed in a very brief amount of time, often in an oral, verbal way. And the rule of faith was very widespread and very broadly used. And you can track in this century the impact of it. You can see different early fathers articulating it and repeating it and appealing to it. And so what it did is it provided sort of a grid, a skeleton of what Christians believed that united people together. Now, just to be clear, this wasn't something that was viewed by Christians as separate from the Bible, as if the Bible were one thing and this was something completely different. Now, they viewed the rule of faith as a summary of what the Bible taught. They viewed it as an articulation of the doctrine of Scripture. So they didn't see it as at odds with Scripture or on par even with Scripture, as if there's two separate things here. But rather, the rule of faith was an expression of what the Scriptures were thought to say. And I think it's just a great argument to show that there was a core bit of unity in early Christianity, much more unity than people typically are willing to admit.
You know, in the last couple chapters, you start to open up other issues that we've discussed before, but it's wonderful to have them here in this book as you speak about a textual culture, the literature of second century Christianity, as well as a new scripture and how the New Testament canon was formed. I do want to refer people and let them know that Mike's been on the program, I think, five previous times, if my count is right, in which we've spoken about the theology and history of the canon, the early text of the New Testament, his book, The Question of Canon, and even, you know, talking about other related issues with Chuck Hill on how God became Jesus as he interacted with Bart Ehrman and other things there. So all of that will be in the links to this episode in the episode description. So those materials are there for you to follow up and listen. But for the sake of our discussion right now, what were some of the issues here, speaking of literature of second century Christianity, you know, features and subjects like oral instruction? Was Christianity an oral culture? And also how early writings started to take shape?
Yeah, so this is a very, in my mind at least, very interesting subject, because I think it's so critical to understanding the emergence of Scripture. There's an idea out there among scholars, as we've discussed before on prior programs, that Christianity was an oral religion that didn't care much about books, that was more interested in just verbal proclamation, and that it wasn't until much later that books were sort of forced on a church that wasn't that textually centered. I find that to be completely at odds with all the evidence. And what I do in this chapter, the last two chapters actually, is I lay out all the evidence for a very textually oriented culture within second century Christianity. And just to put it bluntly, they wrote books and they wrote them in droves, in a ways that most people just never even consider, how much Christians were busy writing.
Even before there were books?
Yeah, exactly.
The technical codices, I should say. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, the term book, of course, used loosely, it was in codex form most of the time. But yeah, Christians wrote. They wrote all kinds of things. They wrote theological treatises. They wrote apologetic defenses. They wrote personal letters. They wrote homilies and scriptural expositions. They wrote commentaries. They wrote, as I also address, what we now call apocryphal literature. You know, sort of similar style books is what we eventually find in the New Testament. But Christians were very, very textually centered and textually focused, and so they wrote all these sorts of things. And I cover a broad swath of this in the chapters. And the point of all of that, of course, is just to remind people that Christianity was not sort of this oral tradition only, uneducated religion, but very much a textually bookish centered religion. And that explains why the canon emerged, because Christians didn't just write books to talk about any old subject. Most of those books were centered on what they thought the scriptures were saying and what the scriptures meant. And they were reflections of scriptural teaching. And so you have very much a bookish religion. Now, you know, one of the things that I think is fascinating about that is just how rare that was in the ancient world. This is another thing that made Christianity very peculiar. I mean, we've already talked about a number of things that make Christianity peculiar. Their exclusive religious practices in terms of worship, their secret meetings. You know, certainly we talked about how they crossed both sort of cultural and even gender lines. These all these things made Christianity peculiar in the eyes of the Romans. But their focus on scripture really made them peculiar, because this wasn't common in the pagan world. You didn't have books at the center of religions in the pagan world. That was just not something they did. And the only group in this time period that's doing this is Judaism. And so Christianity was this obviously not Jewish in the minds of the Romans religion, but yet it still was bookishly centered. And so one of the odd results of this is that many people in the ancient world viewed Christianity not as a religion at all, but as a philosophy. And Jared, you'll note this interesting little trend, because of your philosophical interests, is they just thought Christians were part of a philosophical school, kind of intellectual, bookish people. They weren't, they didn't look like a religion. They didn't look like any religion most Romans would ever recognize as a religion. So in that sense, I just think these chapters highlight one of the most distinctive features of Christianity that people, I think, often forget in our modern day, because we're so used to a religion centered on books. It was not that way in the ancient world.
Yeah, you do. It was interesting. You do highlight the differences between just what people were looking at as far as literature in that time period, the distinction between Christianity, like you say, and the relationship to the text, and then other texts like Homer and Plato and the transmission of those. And I don't know if you want to go into any detail, but there is obviously like a contrast there of, you know, a system of thought being handed down in various forms. So I found that really helpful and interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you know, the only parallel for these Romans was people who are interested in people like Homer and Plato,
yeah,
or philosophers, and so they figured that's what Christianity was. And so, what I love about it is it reminds people that Christianity is not just bookish, but intellectual. And I think this is certainly something that our listeners on this program will resonate with.
Yes,
there's a sense that Christianity was not just about emotions or feeling or quote unquote religion. But it was a worldview, it was a system of thinking, it was a coherent network of theological beliefs that held together. And Christians were very much interested in talking and writing about them. And there's an intellectual side here to religion that just wasn't there in other religious systems in the Greco-Roman world, which is why most of the intellectual opponents for Christianity were philosophers, because that was the appropriate, you know, conversation partner. And I think that it says a lot about our faith and truthfully what we need to recover about faith today. Hmm.
What were some of the obstacles to the formation of the canon in this particular time period? You know, a lot of the New Testament books written before this, but in terms of them being shaped and formed and accepted as New Testament canon, what was going on in the second century?
Yeah, one of the things I argue for here is that very early on in the second century, we can see a core collection of books emerging. Even when I say core, really something like 21, 22 out of 27 books emerging as a fairly clear and identifiable and used set of sources for early Christians. To say it another way, it seems like in the second century, there's wide agreement on a core that there really wasn't that much meaningful dispute over. It was just sort of there from the start. and that all the dispute we typically hear about is really over about four or five books, typically the smaller ones. And I point that out for the readers because I want them to realize that the second century was yes, transitional in one sense, and that the canon wasn't completely resolved, but in another sense, it was largely already there. And so you have an interesting sort of combination of things, that the core collection that was stable and solid, but then a sort of a fuzzy border where some of these peripheral books were still being discussed. The reason that matters, of course, is it eliminates a lot of these misconceptions about the canon, that it was completely in disarray until the fourth or fifth century. And this hopefully puts that to rest, because I think the second century is great evidence that there was a canon very early.
I really appreciate all of the details and the subject matter of this book. It's been tremendously fruitful for me, edifying in many different ways. But of course, we're not just studying these things just to know more things. This actually has an influence on us in understanding our history, our tradition as Christians. But one thing that you mentioned early on in the book, we've talked about today a little bit, but then really start to speak more specifically about and looking forward to how Christianity was at the crossroads here in the second century, but how so many of these things have to do with Christians now living in the 21st century. Do you have any thoughts or comments, perhaps any exhortations for pilgrims on the way, and how we can understand ourselves as Christians, as the body of Christ, living in a largely similar culture, although some of the particulars are different in terms of technology and whatnot, but the more things change, as they say, the more things remain the same.
Yeah, I end the book in my final sort of conclusion with some of those thoughts about how this applies to the modern day. And basically what I say there is that I think the second century is the closest mirror of the current cultural moment we're in. And here's what I mean by that. So if you were to live in the United States 100 years ago and asked which of the early centuries of the church we would relate to the most, it would not have been the second century.
Yeah.
Because 100 years ago in America, Christianity was a mostly thriving, dominant religious system, at least culturally. The culture reflected Christian values, even if most people weren't necessarily converted. You still had a quote-unquote Christian world. And what I mean by that, of course, is just that they shared a Christian worldview largely. And so, you know, 100 years ago in America, we may have looked more like the 5th century of early Christianity. But now, with the cultural shift going on, one of the things I've noticed is that I feel like we can recover again how much we have in common with the 2nd century. Now, of course, we're not at a point in America where we're being martyred and killed, at least not now, like the 2nd century. But we are in a place in America where we've lost our sort of cultural influence, and we no longer have the same cultural influence we used to. We're very much a minority voice now, speaking into a largely pagan world. And when I look at the second century, I realize that's our mirror, that's our conversation partner. Those folks, what they faced and dealt with there, are very much the kind of things that we're going to be facing and are facing now. So I think the lessons are just abundant for that reason. We need to learn again how to be a prophetic voice in a world where we're a minority voice, where we're not in control and not in power, but yet are trying to influence people's thinking. And I think we've lost that art, and hopefully this book will help people recover it.
Yeah, I think so. And that'd be my hope for this book, too. Of course, we need people to read it for that to be the case, but they're going to enjoy it. And so, you know, we've been speaking about Mike's book, Christianity at the Crossroads, How the Second Century Shaped the Future of the Church by Michael J. Kruger. You can find that wherever good books are sold. We particularly enjoy and want to refer people back to WTSbooks.com, but of course, not the only place where you can find it. This has been published by IVP Academic in the United States. We know a majority of our listeners are in the U.S., but it's also published by SPCK if you are elsewhere in the world and would like to get it from another vantage point or vector. So thanks so much today for joining us, Mike. It's been a pleasure. It always is. And we look forward to having you back next time.
Thanks, guys. Fun conversation. Appreciate the time to chat about the book, and I look forward to being on again soon.
You bet. Jared, it's also good to speak with you. And if anybody needs to get in touch with us, you certainly can contact us at reformedforum.org. All of our contact information is on the page. You can, of course, contact Reformed Theological Seminary through rts.edu and get in touch with any of the people at their various seminary locations. Mike, of course, teaching and ministering down in Charlotte, North Carolina. So I encourage you to check them out as well online. I do want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.